The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, number 126, for Monday, November 5th, 2007.
Welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave Hamilton. Of course, I am here this week with John Braun. Hi, John. How are you?
Fantastic. Boy, this just, we got an extra hour. That's cool.
Oh, the show gets two. Is it going to be like 2 hours tonight or something?
No.
Oh. You're referring to daylight savings time.
I'm just going
to
mention this. Okay, if you are in the United States, you know what tomorrow is?
Nope.
Hello?
Nope. I don't. Oh, tomorrow's election day.
In a lot of places. So, number one, it means the kids get the day off a lot of times because they use schools. But number two, if you can vote, you better vote. Otherwise, if something doesn't work right in the future, it's your fault.
That's right.
And if you voted, then you have a right to take to the streets with the torches and pitchforks. And
well, get your sharpen your pitchforks tonight, folks, and then tomorrow night you can go after all of the unvoting masses. But for tonight, we're going to talk about stuff that has to do with the Mac. And really, whether you vote or not doesn't matter, at least not tonight, about the Mac, about the show. But otherwise, I agree with John. He's absolutely right. So we've got more stuff. We're going to actually wrap up the show. And by wrap up, I mean maybe the second half of the show will be more stuff about Leopard. We've got a keychain thing to talk about that's actually a little bit different, though probably a precursor to the keychain problems that folks have been reporting with Leopard and that John and I talked about a little bit last week. And then we've got a whole bunch of your questions, torrents, auto mounting, and perhaps even more, depending on how far we go here.
But you know, you could vote your questions, I think.
They can vote with their questions? Is that right?
Were there emails?
If they want to vote for the podcast, they could go to Podcast Alley there and vote for the Geek Gab right on Podcast Alley and try and drive up the numbers. And I'm not sure what that does in the end, but I guess it looks good. So that's good. It helps. You know, it's nice. Show of support. Wearing your Geek Gab badge proud. All that good stuff. It's not a bad thing.
Okay.
Great, Stewie. This is going nowhere. Let's talk about Mike. Mike says, I'm a longtime listener to the show, and I'm always anticipating the next episode of it. I download the TV shows I watch through torrents, mainly because there are no TV shows section in the Canadian iTunes store, and put the torrent files into a BitTorrent program called Azurius. My internet service provider says on their website that the service I have should be running at about 5 megabits per second, but whenever I download anything, be it a file through my web browser or a TV show through Azurius, my downloads run at about 12 to 15 K per second. I do use a router, and thought that might be the cause, but it happens even when my computer is the only one connected and I've disabled the Wi-Fi part of it. I was wondering if you guys could help me out with this problem. And he's using a D-Link router. All right. So
number one here. Okay. He may be involved in some technical naughtiness. Can we?
Okay.
Because you did read the background on this.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like he's torrenting for a lack of something, but as we all know, just the caution here is that some may view this as something that's not a good thing to do.
That's right.
Even I would agree if the content's not available to you through a legitimate channel, you can buy it. So anyways, just a little disclaimer there.
That's right. But there are valid uses for torrents. In fact, there were...
Oh, absolutely. It's being supported by real companies, right?
Prior to iTunes coming out, there were a lot of podcasts, not prior to iTunes coming out, prior to iTunes supporting podcasts internally, there were a plenty of podcatchers that would support BitTorrent, and a lot of podcasts like Dave Slusher's Evil Genius Chronicles was one of them that was mainly distributed through BitTorrent. And just as a little tangent here, BitTorrent works, and this is actually not really a tangent, BitTorrent works by, if let's say you have downloaded half or maybe all of something. Let's take a podcast, for example. So we're not crossing any, you know, there's no legal boundaries. It's totally fine, right? So you've downloaded it and 10 other people have downloaded it. And then John starts to go and he wants to download it. Well, he doesn't download it from any one of us. He downloads it from all of us, and we each chop it up into chunks. And this happens, but with the client and server, it's one app that does both and chops it up into chunks. And maybe he'll get chunk three from me and chunk two from Timmy and chunk one from Mike. And you know,
Timmy.
Yeah.
You know, Timmy. Trust Timmy.
Well, Timmy.
But I think it's a many to many thing opposed to a many to, well, I don't know, one to many. And I think that's what makes it really kind of cool is that it spreads around to everybody.
So to answer half of the bandwidth question there with related to torrents, you won't necessarily see, you know, the 5 megabits a second is theoretically your download maximum. But if the people from whom you are getting the torrent can't support 5 megabits a second. Let's say you're downloading from 10 people and each of them supports 10K a second. Well, then the most you'll see if you're downloading all 10 chunks simultaneously from those 10 people is 100K per second. And so that's how that works. If you are downloading from, you know, people that can each support a megabit a second and you're downloading from 10 of them, well, then you would see your 5 megabits because you'd hit your max before they hit theirs. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Some of the other things I've observed is that, so one is the torrent that you want to be part of. The more other people that are part of it, and the torrent trackers will typically show this, the number of people that are seeding and connected and all that to a particular torrent. So the more people, the better, because it kind of learns as the longer it runs, the more people, and you can see this in clients, it'll show the more people are part of what's called a swarm. And actually you can view the swarm and start seeing the people that know about you and can either take things from you or give things to you. So that's one thing. And not everybody may have a high-speed connection. So as Dave pointed out, unless everybody cumulatively that you know about, and that's another thing. Depending on the right, if you pick the right torrent, you may never find enough people that can provide your maximum bandwidth, I guess is
that's
what
it.
I'm trying to say.
That crystallizes the thought perfectly. Now, the other thing Mike mentioned was that he's never seeing, in fact, he's seeing that same 12 to 15K per second through website downloads. Now, again, not all web servers are created equal and not everybody has maximum bandwidth, but if you're always seeing that, that does indicate that there might be some sort of network problem. The best thing to do is to go to one of the many speed tests available. I use speedtest.net. That's my current favorite, and I've been using it for, I don't know, about the last year. And it's proven very reliable. Do a couple of tests, and you'll see that it'll fall in line. If you're not getting full speed from that, call your provider. You've got some issues. You did the right thing by pulling your router out of the mix because, frankly, that's what your provider is going to suggest you do. So you might as well just do it and test it on your own that way. But beyond that, then there's got to be some issue out there.
Right. So what you're saying now, you can test. Do a local test and just see.
Right.
Because it could be because like the Linksys and others have features which can potentially limit bandwidth, which may be a good thing, especially if you have a lot of people. You don't want anybody hogging all the bandwidth, so that could be the case.
They don't work, though, just for if you are, and I know he's bypassed his router, but we've talked about this before using QoS, quality of service. Mm-hmm. The Linksys and D-Link routers, all the stuff that you can buy for $100 or less.
Yeah.
A lot of them have QoS built in or have the ability to use it. All of them suck. They cannot support it properly. They'll never work right. In order to do QoS right, you've got to spend big bucks on a much better router. Otherwise, you're not going to see your maximum bandwidth, and you'll have a lot of problems. We've talked about this before, but I just wanted to put that out there.
Now, another thing could be happening, Dave.
Yeah,
some ISPs. Internet service providers, whether it be cable or DSL or modem, sometimes they see certain types of traffic, which
good point.
They may not be too happy about.
Yeah, that's right.
That's another thing is that if your provider sees traffic which they think may be questionable, they may throw that as well. Now, Azurius actually has a feature. If you go to preferences, connection, transport, encryption, require encrypted transport, it will attempt to mask your traffic to prevent being profiled. And this is kind of the whole back and forth that has happened many times in many worlds here where you try to mask what you're doing and people figure out how to detect it and all that stuff. So your provider may not be too happy about what you're trying to do. So enabling that feature may change things. Try it out. See what happens.
There was actually an issue recently. We'll mention this and then move on. Where Comcast, which is the provider we have here at TMO Towers East in Durham, New Hampshire, and Comcast was actually not filtering the packets, but they were using a product called Sandvine to go out and figure out which packets were Nutella or potentially BitTorrent packets. And what it would do is it would phony a response back to you saying, nope, this has been dropped. Then 5 minutes later, it might let it through. And it was their way of doing packet shaping or bandwidth shaping. And at first they denied it. And then they finally came out and said, yeah, we're doing some of that. We're not really blocking traffic, but, we've been doing some of this. So hopefully it seems like that's actually gotten better since they admitted that they were doing it. So maybe they've knocked that number down. So it should be interesting. All right. Moving on to something that sounds like it's going to be crossing the lines of legality, but actually isn't, from Eric about DVD region codes. I think.
Hi, Matt Geek. This is Eric Meatleg calling from Osaka, Japan. I love the show, and I've got what I think should be an easy question for you. Like a lot of people living in a country that they didn't grow up in, I've got some problems with region codes on DVDs. Now, I already know how to use MacDeliver to make a backup copy of DVDs that I already own to remove region codes on DVDs that are of the region code that my Mac is currently set to. But my question is about watching DVDs without having to burn a copy. I want to know if I buy an external DVD drive, can I set the external drive to one region code and have my internal drive to another region code? I've heard that this may be doable before, but I wanted to confirm with the kings of Mac geekdom before I buy an experiment. I've got a PowerBook G4, 1.5 gigahertz and 2 gigabytes of RAM, and a friend of mine who's also interested in this answer has a new aluminum iMac. Both of us are in Japan with our Macs set to region code 2, and wish to watch our legally purchased region code 1 movies from the U.S. on an external drive without switching the settings on my computer, because there's a limit of about 5 times that you can switch before your region code is stuck. Thanks a lot. Don't get caught.
There it is. Okay. Just had to get that don't get caught in there. So I think John and I, we both researched this separately and found that, yeah, absolutely, you can do this. And the trick is that you can't switch it back and forth on any given drive, but the region code is not set to your computer. It is actually set physically inside the DVD drive, to the point where if you did region lock your drive and had a reason that you wanted to have an internal drive with a different region, you could, and this might void the warranty, you know, but you could open up your Mac and swap out the DVD burner, or, you know, the DVD drive itself that's inside your Mac. And then you'd get 5 more chances to do that. Right. Presuming that you swapped it out with a new one and not a used one. So
Now I could only speculate that there are people that may have written utilities which could make your drive think it's brand new.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's been firmware.
And yeah, things go awry, you will have a nice little paperweight. So beware.
Yeah. Yeah.
This solution sounds great. I mean, as long as once you lock a drive, I mean, there's that, you know, typically five reset limit. I mean, once you lock a drive, I mean, that sounds like a good solution, is just to have different drives for different regions. I mean, it probably makes the DVD drive manufacturers very happy.
Yeah.
I think regions should be discarded altogether, but that's just me and probably you and most of the consumer public.
Anybody that actually spends money on this stuff, as opposed to the people that make money on it. But, you know, hey, what are you talking about? So speaking of making money, we have a sponsor here for our show. Our first sponsor is Smile on My Mac. And this week we're actually talking about a different product than we usually do. We're talking about Text Expander. Now, Text Expander was just updated to version 2.0. In general, what Text Expander does is it allows you to create little text snippets. For example, let's say I have, we talk to people all the time and are constantly emailing, you know, with folks who are going to send us items for review. And sometimes they've got to mail them if it's a physical item versus a download. So instead of going to my address book and looking up John's address each time and then typing it into my email, I have set a shortcut where I type comma JFB for John F. Braun, ADD. So comma JFB ADD. And bam, it puts John's whole address right in the email. I know it's right. It's the same every time. Good to go. And that's it. It just magically appears after a little popping sound. And it's very nice. I do it with various little things that I need to enter regularly into forms or email. It kind of works system wide. And it's a beautiful thing. They've updated it to 2.0. 2.0 adds a couple of different things. Snippet groups, meaning you can have various different groups that you can turn on and off, and you can enable or disable those groups on a per application basis. So if you know that you're only going to have your signatures in mail, well, only attach them to mail. And then that way, if you happen to hit that same keystroke in a web form, it won't blast your signature in there. It'll just happily ignore it. Also supports a favorite feature of mine, dot Mac synchronization, so that I can have the same snippet groups on all of my Macs. And one very geeky feature, AppleScript snippets. What this means, inside the snippet, you can have AppleScript run, and the results of the AppleScript will be pasted or included in with the snippet output. So that is Smile on My Mac's Text Expander version 2.0. It is a free upgrade for anyone who owned a prior version or 1.x. It's $29.95 to buy it out of the gate. So check it out at smileonmymac.com. And with that, Ed has something to say about auto mount shares.
Hey guys, really like the show every week. What I have is a question, being a fairly recent switcher myself. I have a network in my home. I have a number of shared drives on a Windows network. I would love it so that every time I log into the network, these shared drives would show up as, speaking in Windows speak, shortcuts, basically, on my desktop. Appreciate it, guys. By the way, I'm running Windows XP Pro on those machines out there.
Any thoughts on this one, John?
Automount.
All right. Well, I've got a thought.
I think there's a place you can do this. I think you found it. I'll let you go with it. You found it, but it may not be immediately obvious where to go. So
yeah, okay. So I've done this and it's worked. If you go into System Preferences, I should say I've done this and it's worked in Tiger. I have not tested this in Leopard because we actually prepped this question before we installed Leopard on our production machines. You go to System Preferences, Accounts, Login Items, click the plus key, and then highlight the share that you've already mounted and click Add. That will add it in there. If you have told it when you've logged in from the Finder to save the password in the keychain, then it will auto mount. And that's been my experience. I don't see why that wouldn't work in Leopard, but I had a
it
weird...
It looks the same. I'm here in the Login Items, and it looks to me identical.
Okay.
I have a plus. You can add things. I can imagine, all the things I have listed are kind application.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you can add kind alias, I guess that would be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, a little thing I noticed while we were talking about this, Dave, sharing is that, sharing up until very recently has been kind of a highly granular thing in that OS X... Without third-party products, it was really hard to share things other than whole drives or volumes. But you may have noticed that with Leopard now, we can do, thank goodness, folder-level sharing.
Yeah, no kidding. This just in from OS 9, right? We had the thing last week, which was the grid spacing, and now we've got shares that you can set. It's cool. You can either set them in the sharing preference pane or... You were mentioning this earlier, John. I think you can just do get info, right, and turn a share on there.
Yes, there's now just a little box that says, share.
It's that simple, folks.
So, nice work. So it's nice to bring some of the, features that Windows and other OSs have had for a while back.
Yeah. Yeah, that was something I missed, was that.
And actually, I think they have better group functionality, though I still have to work with that. We're going to, I think, talk about that in a future episode, but it looks like group definitions and sharing among groups is also enhanced now in Leopard.
Ah, okay. Okay. Yeah, I'm eager to hear what you find about that, because you always find the little nuances that that I tend to
I've just noticed some dialogue boxes now look different when you're talking about sharing and permission. So, we'll get to it.
Okay. We are going to get into Leopard here, but first I wanted to talk about the keychain because there's something that's been going on, and whether or not this is related to all of the issues that have been happening with Leopard, I wanted to talk about this. Now, I believe it was in 10.2, but I could be wrong. It could have been 10.3 when the macOS 10 prior to that with 10.0 and 10.1 certainly, and then maybe 10.2, the default keychain that was created for your user account was the same name as your short username. So for me, that would be Dave. And that was where all of my stuff was stored. At some point along the line, the default for newly created user accounts became called login, and the file name was login.keychain. And that's how it exists today. So, and macOS 10, if you had an upgraded account, it would just keep you going along and it wouldn't impose this login.keychain thing on you.
So but, every user normally has two keychain files if you did it in the old days.
No.
Right?
No. No. Well, with Tiger, that changed. Yeah. So you had one keychain file for the user. There were other keychain files for the system, but one for each user by default. You could, of course, add jillions of them if you like for various different purposes. But the one for your user was by default short username prior to 10.3 and then login after that. And there was good reason for this, and I noticed it instantly when I created a new when I set up a new computer, when I set up a new computer with Tiger, the default keychain was login, and I tried to sync it with my .Mac, and things got really kind of squirrely, and so that's when I realized, oh, I better change this computer. And so on the new computer, I just made the default keychain named Dave, and then everything was fine. But occasionally, I'd have weird little issues. And then with Tiger, especially with .Mac, it started creating this login keychain, and there were things it insisted on storing in there. And, I just dealt with it. It wasn't that big of a deal. Never really had a problem. And then heard about all these people having problems with the keychains. And, of course, last week I had not yet upgraded my MacBook Pro. I have since. I did it on Tuesday evening. So I decided, I've thought about doing this for a while. Why don't I go to all three of my Macs and make my keychain, update my keychain name and make it what the macOS is going to be looking for. So I did. I migrated from my old keychain, which was named Dave, to a new keychain, which is called Login. And I did it by taking the following steps. So first, I quit all of my apps because I didn't want any apps trying to access the keychain while I did this. Then I opened Keychain Access. And on the left at the top, you should see a list of your keychains. If you don't, go to the View menu, choose Show Keychains. Then click on the Login keychain, highlight everything in there, and drag it to your short username keychain. For me, it was all that stuff was to Dave. There were a couple things where it said, this item exists in both places, so I'm not going to move it. That's fine. At that point, go to the File menu, lock all the keychains, and then quit Keychain Access. So you've got all the stuff you want in the keychain with your username, your current default keychain, which has everything. Go to into the Finder, go to Home, Library, Keychains, and you're going to do two rename operations. You're going to take the current login.keychain and rename it to login.old, and then you're going to rename the short username keychain, in my case, Dave, to login.keychain. That's the magic. Then we reopen Keychain Access. There will be the login keychain there, and then Dave was grayed out. But none of them were set as default. So I highlight login, go to File, make keychain login default, quit, reboot. Next time I come back around, everything's fine. And I've been happy on all three of my Macs since. So that's the path I took. I then did the upgrade to Leopard and didn't have any problems. But that's the way the macOS wants to see it. They've standardized on login keychain being the keychain name, and then that way you can sync without any issues. Everything's good. It's the right way to go. I understand why they've done it, and that's where you have it.
Okay. No, that's good to know, because I ran into very annoying keychain problems. Because I accessed them from way, way back, and it had both of them. And I think things are working good. But, yeah, the discussion boards had a lot of a lot of talk about that.
Yeah.
So, so one point or another, you get bit because of, I guess, that mix of different keychains.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, it's also one little thing is just in general, if you are in keychain access, there is this handy little thing under the keychain access menu called keychain first aid. It may not hurt to run that every now and then.
Good idea.
Just to make sure the structure of the files in your keychain is makes sense to the utility.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah. Before we get into Leopard here, I will tell you about our second sponsor for the show, and that is Audible. You've heard us talk about it before, and we'll talk about it now. Audible is a place where you can go and get almost 40,000 different audiobooks, and you can get one of them for free by visiting audible.com/MacGeekGab. Then you'll be able to download. It sucks it right into iTunes. You can sync it with your iPod. You can burn it to a CD, or you can just sit there and listen to it right at your Mac, or if you're on a Windows machine, that'll work too. All kinds of great stuff. How to Survive a Robot Uprising. Stephen Levy's The Perfect Thing, all about the iPod. Alan Deutschman's The Second Coming of Steve Jobs. And the iWAS book, How I Invented the Personal Computer and Had Fun Along the Way. Again, in order to get a 14-day free trial of the Audible Listener Gold and the one free download, you got to use audible.com/MacGeekGab. And we look forward to hearing what you think about it. If you this and any other advertiser, let us know. Check it out. Let us know what you think. audible.com/MacGeekGab. And with that, we jump right into Leopard. The first thing we're going to talk about is something you've probably seen other folks talk about. And John, I'm going to let you start here with the Leopard firewall.
Do we have to?
Oh. Go, baby.
Oh, I don't know. You know, I had high hopes because, you know, OS X has always done a fairly good job, especially in Tiger, of taking the underlying firewall and making it understandable. Now, it was in the sharing control panel in Tiger, which, you know, some people may think is kind of a weird place, but it kind of made sense because the sharing services and the firewall are related from a network point of view. So in Leopard, they, I don't know. Oh, gosh.
Well, the first thing they did was they moved it to the security preference pane, right?
Yeah, so they moved it there, but even
we
then,
can live
so
with that. That's right.
I'm okay with moving it because it's a security tool, it's a sharing tool. Okay. But here's the thing. So first off, I trusted them. So when I migrated my machine, it said, you know, transfer all your settings, and I thought there was an explicit thing saying firewall settings and security settings. So maybe I misread it, but I thought it all come over. So here's the first problem. So you start up Leopard, everything's great, Migration Assistant is done. And I finally find this control panel, and it's like, oh, it's off. Allow all incoming connections. Now, you know, at least in my security book, that's probably not a good default setting.
Well, it lets everything work just right.
And you know, I got to give him a smackdown for this. I mean, don't, at least come up with a dialogue saying, by the way, you know, I'm letting the world into your computer via the internet. Are you okay with that? Or would you like to maybe set things up to be a little bit more secure? So I can't.
All right, so that's gripe.
I'm not the only one that said this. So that's bad. They start up with the firewall. So then you, but then the other thing is that when you look at now, the way you set it up before, because it was tightly coupled to the services that you were sharing, it kind of makes sense what was on and off. Now you have only three options here, and they're very restrictive. So as we mentioned, when it starts up, allow all incoming connections. Bad idea. And then the other one, which is probably even worse, block all incoming connections. And then they have a third one, set access for specific services and applications. And in theory, what's supposed to happen is when you set it to this is you start up applications that believe they need to mess with the firewall. They'll kind of get added to the rule base. The problem is it'll just list the applications and only bring it to the level of allow or deny for this specific application, which right now in mine I have iTunes, Safari, iChat Agent, Skype, Azurius, whatever.
Yeah.
But the only options available to me are allow and block. I can't see what they're doing, which you could with the prior Tiger invocation. So I don't think it's so much that anything about the firewall has changed, but the I don't know. I got to say it. I mean, the interface just got a heavy dose of suck. I mean,
yeah, it's a lot less
it's
functional.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
I just don't know what they were thinking.
Yeah. Doesn't make
I'm
sense
sorry,
to me.
Sorry, Apple, but guys, it's just, I mean, it may have been an attempt to make it easy to use, but you can't even get to the point where people who know how to tweak it and want to see the ports and stuff can even get at it. And that's what really frustrates me.
Yeah. Yeah, I imagine that we're going to see, I hope, maybe it's not my imagination, it's hope springs eternal here for us to shortly see a better interface. I can understand wanting to give a very simple interface for the firewall and have this auto configuration thing happen, and that's great. But what if I know I want to go and let people talk to my computer on port 2731, right? That's my choice. I want to do that, but I want to block everything else. Well, right now I got to go to the command line. I don't know of a way to do it in the GUI, and there was one in the
yeah, now what it does, if you want to add something, it asks you to point to the application in question, which, right. What if it's, you know, what if you just want to set up your own without pointing to an application? So again, I can understand how they're making it easy, because in theory, the application will say, hey, I need these ports, and the firewall will set itself up. And that actually sounds nice in theory, but I think it's premature. So
I agree. Yeah. And yeah, and when you add it, when you add an app, it's allow or block. That's it.
So, now, from what I understand, it's a standards-based firewall underneath it all. So I imagine there are probably already third-party utilities that can dig into the configuration files and make sense of this. But for the default interface, I'm less than thrilled.
And that's so good.
That's all I got to say about that.
All right. So I'm a big user of iChat, and though we're not going to talk about all the video stuff that's here, I do want to talk about some of the more buried things in the text interface. So you all know that I'm a huge fan of iChat with tabs. And of course, Chax was the thing that solved that for me months or maybe even a year ago. Well, of course, Chax doesn't work yet with iChat 4.0, which is what we have in Leopard. So we have to, but as Steve Jobs showed us, iChat now supports tabs natively. So I thought, great, where is it? How do I turn it on? I'm digging through all the menus. I had to go to the Apple list of 300 features to see if it had been taken out. It wasn't. It's there. You got to go to the prefs, the iChat menu, go to preferences, go to messages pane. And then there's a little checkbox that says collect chats into a single window. Yeah, that's intuitive. Okay, and Jeff Gamet, bless his heart, did a little tip for us at TMO, and we'll link to that article, but it says the same thing. While you're there, there's also a cool another option that says, watch for my name in incoming messages. And this is handy because you can have it alert you when someone types your name into a chat window, and you can have it alert you differently. That's pretty cool. One other thing I used, Chax.
That's very good. I got to mention, because every once in a blue moon, I will get an AIM message out of the blue. And I know it's not someone I know, but it's a bot. And the thing is, they don't know my name, so they'll do like hi or a wink or a...
Right.
You probably know what they want, but it's like, I mean, you immediately discard those. So I can imagine this is a great feature for kind of discarding these probably annoying little, fishing expeditions here. But anyway, sorry. I just wanted to mention. That sounds very, very applicable to that problem.
Well, here's how I use it. We have a TMO chat room that we keep going all day. It's just for TMO staffers, for the on duty guys, and we all kind of keep a little conversation going there. But I found myself having to log out of it because if I wasn't involved in a conversation there, because if there was another conversation happening, I was constantly getting these, AIM sounds that new messages were coming in, and it gets distracting. Well, now I don't have to do that anymore. In the view menu, there's another hidden little option called use alerts in this chat. And of course, by default, it's on. You can turn it off. And so I can do that for the TMO chat. And now the conversation goes on. I have no idea if anything's happening, but if someone says, Dave, are you there? that's when that's when iChat makes a noise because I've told it to watch for my name in incoming messages. And then I know, oh, let me go over here, see what they need. And I can go through the history. So if they're talking about, well, I'm having some problem with this, maybe we should check with Dave. Bam, I'm alerted. And now I've got the history because I've already been in the room. Very, very handy. One last thing that I used Chax for was as new messages come in, you have to accept them. And this is a very, very annoying feature of iChat. And Chax let you bypass it saying auto accept incoming messages. Well, this is possible in iChat 4. And I'm not certain, but I think this may have been possible in iChat 3. If you go to iChat prefs and go to alerts, and then for text for text invitation, you check the run Apple script box and then select the pre-installed comes with the OS auto accept Apple script. And you can also do this with incoming file transfers if you want those to be auto accepted as well. And works really, really well. So just wanted to throw those iChat things out there. And I think that's it. John, you've got something about remote access and sharing to talk about here for us.
Before that, I just want to mention one thing. Maybe worthwhile, just very quickly, because we were talking about updated software. Now, in this day and age of Leopard, people may be wondering, gee, do my applications need an update to work properly?
Yeah.
And the thing I would recommend, we've talked about it before, but I'll just mention here, is AppFresh. When you're doing a system upgrade, it may be worthwhile to run something like AppFresh, or there are a few other things, but that's the one that I like using. Just to let you know that something may need a little tweak. I actually did that before I committed my machine to Time Machine. I actually updated all of the stuff, so at least I was packing up something that was in a decent state. But then, now, back to what you were saying, Dave. One thing I liked was remote access. And now, like many, I hope, who have multiple machines, I have my G5, dual G5 has Leopard on it. My PowerBook G4 still has Tiger on it because, one, I just want to maintain the... I don't want to put all my eggs in one basket. But anyways, the remote access works wonderfully. So the cool thing now is if you go to... So on the Tiger machine, all you have to do is make sure you go to the system preference. Is it remote access? I think it's remote access that you have to enable. And that allows things like Apple Remote Desktop and other services to remotely come to your machine or use VNC.
Yeah, you
so
go,
I'm sorry, it's
go
Apple to the, Remote Desktop under the services.
In the sharing pane.
Sharing Tiger. And then the cool thing now is in Leopard on the sidebar on the left, there's now a new shared category. So if it sees a machine out there that is offering sharing capabilities, it just appears there, which I think is very, very nice and very, very intuitive because otherwise you kind of had to know the machine was there. Now, there may be a security aspect to this. But the cool thing is that if you double-click on the machine there, it'll say share screen, connect as VNC, and then it'll run a little app called screen sharing. And it's like, huh, where is that? And here's the thing. So this is only for super advanced propeller beanie geeks here. Be very careful, but if you go to System Library Core Services, there will be a bunch of things in there. Some are interesting, and one is called screen sharing, which is the app that runs when you make this connection. Now, be very, very careful. There are some things in there that you may not want to touch unless you know what the heck you're doing. So look, don't touch. But the remote access is very nice, and I'm looking forward to checking out some of the other things. I think, Dave, you and I are going to check out some of the iChat screen sharing. That looks very nice.
Yep.
And I guess the Back to My Mac thing also, I guess, is a form of that.
Yeah, very cool.
So that's remote access looks like it's definitely taken a step forward, and it's cool that it works between different versions of the OS. I think it's a nice touch.
Cool. All right. So I'm a big fan now of Apple's Mail, and I've been using it for a while, and I really like the search functionality. In fact, I have all my incoming mail. Once I file it, it all gets filed into one place, and I simply use search. So, I upgraded to Leopard. Everything was fine. I went to do a search and I typed in my terms and I could search by subject, from, or to, but entire message was grayed out. I thought, wow, what the heck is going on here? And so, I asked Jeff Gamet in our TMO chat room, I said, do you have a problem with this in Leopard? He's like, God, I hope not. He went and checked. Nope, works fine for me. And so I started digging around And then I went into system preferences, into the Spotlight preference, because I remembered Mail has its own database where it stores from, to, and subject, but the entire message search happens in Spotlight, and Mail just kind of taps into that service. So I went to Spotlight and thought, well, maybe it's because Mail is turned off, because I don't want my Mail messages appearing in my general Spotlight search. I only want them appearing if I'm searching Mail. So I turned that on. No, no problem. Then I went to the Privacy tab in Spotlight. Sure enough, every drive on my system, including my boot drive, was listed here. So I had no Spotlight service whatsoever running. And the interesting thing was, you know, last week we talked about how you could type a math equation into Spotlight and you would get an answer. Well, if you don't have anything at all indexed, or maybe even if you don't have your boot drive indexed in Spotlight, you will not get any answers from the math, because I was having problems with that on my MacBook. Worked fine on the iMac, didn't work on the MacBook. So, so once I did that, you know, Spotlight went and took, I don't know, a couple of hours to rebuild its index on my machine, and then, bam, everything started working great. So, one nice thing, I know I should be using Quicksilver. I know you've all told me about it. I've tried it. I haven't been able to wrap my head around it. Everybody that I know uses it, other than you, John. I don't think you do either. But no. Everybody else does. I don't use Quicksilver. I use Spotlight to launch apps. And yes, in Tiger, it was slow. And yes, in Leopard, it's way faster, because the applications that match the search terms that you're typing come up first. Then the rest of the stuff fills in as the search finds it. So if you're going to launch an app, command spacebar, you start typing the name of the app. You don't even have to hit command enter anymore. It sits there right on the application. You just hit enter or return. Bam, off you go. So that's my
nice.
My piece.
No doubt
Spotlight.
Due to somebody watching how people used it or wanted to use it.
Bingo.
And noting their frustration when things would appear and then disappear.
Bingo. Yeah. Yeah. That's what sucked. It was like, I almost made it. Very, very frustrating. Now it just works smooth, glass, silk, all that good stuff. You got something to talk about? I've got something. And then I think we're getting the heck out of here.
Can I talk about which thing?
Did you have anything else? Some warnings perhaps on your list?
That one. No, I got a list here. But I noticed one thing here is that with the increased problem with, questionable downloads. Now what happens is when you download certain things and you try to launch the app, it'll say, application, blah, blah, was downloaded from the internet. Are you sure you want to open it? And I downloaded it from here. And then it gives you, and it says, do you want to do this? So I think it's nice is that they're giving you more detail about downloads, because, the Mac is not going to be immune forever, and there may be downloads that are questionable. What I think this dialogue doing is trying to preempt an attack where in the past you may not have known where you got things from. This makes it a little bit clearer as to where download came from. So if you see, you downloaded, application erase hard drive from, hacker.com, you may not want to run it. So it'll give you that level. I mean, there's still ways to get around it, but I think it's nice that they're increasing the amount of information that they're asking the user to look at before they approve something. Now, there's also another option, which I think you got to check, which is don't warn me again. Otherwise, from what I've seen, this may be just a slip I made at some point. It'll incessantly warn you whenever it tries to launch that app if you don't click that checkbox the first time you launch it. I don't know if you've been through this dialogue, Dave. Have you?
I have, and I haven't. I think the don't warn me again is a global thing, because I haven't been warned about the same app twice. I let it go and then bam, it just hadn't given me any issue. So
maybe there was one where it was checked and I unchecked it. I don't know.
Got it.
Okay. That's a nice touch. And what else you got?
I talked last week about Spaces a little bit, and I've really, really begun using these quite a bit. One thing that I found frustrating was when I rebooted my machine, I had to switch to the space that I wanted a certain app in and drag the, and then launch the app and move the app into that space and leave it there. Then I dug into the preferences a little more and found that you can tell individual apps to open in certain spaces. So now, like on my computer at home, I have three spaces. I've got the space where I have my email. I have the space where I have my Net Newswire client, and also my NewsWatcher, because I still read some Usenet groups. And then I have a third space for iTunes, just to make it easier to manage that and not have to dig through Windows to deal with iTunes, because we play iTunes in the house through the iMac. And So now I've set it all up so that when I launch iTunes, it automatically goes to Space 3, NetNewsWire, and NewsWatcher in Space 2, and then email in Space 1. And instantly I found that I was having a problem, especially in Spaces 1 and 2, where I wanted Safari access to both, because sometimes I'll click a link and I want it to open in Safari from Mail or from NetNewsWire. And in addition to choosing which space you want something to open in, you can also tell an app to live in all spaces, or every space is the option. And what's very cool about that is as you move spaces, all the other apps move around. And in this case, Safari stays right where it is. So now I've got Safari in every space. It'd be cool to say Safari in Spaces 1 and 2, but not 3. And maybe they'll get to the point where we can have some checkboxes, because it would be cool not to have it in the iTunes space, but to have it in the other two. And so only time will tell. But that was that. And one last thing I will mention here is, and a reader pointed it out to me today, actually, the terminal now has tabs, and it's automatically enabled. Just Command T. It's the same interface as Safari. Thank goodness for that. Very, very
terminal
nice.
With tabs.
That's right. Terminal with tabs. And I think that's
about it.
That's it for the content. We do have this great
band.
The band's here.
Hold up, huh? We had a frost a couple days ago.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. It's crazy. Crazy, crazy. We do have a great deal on a hotel for Macworld Expo. We'll link to the article here at TMO, but you can stay at the Hotel Milano if you use the TMO code or just link to it from TMO, and it'll get you right there. You save $5 for every room night that you book, and it helps. It's a nice hotel. The website looks horrible, to be honest with you. Brian Chaffin went and checked it out personally, checked out a bunch of rooms there. Really, really like this place. So this is the place to stay. Go ahead and check out the
spot.
It's a hot spot. It's right around the corner. Yep. Not a bad location at all. So that's I think that's what we have to say from that. We're getting out of here. Right? You got anything else to talk about here, John?
No.
Going through the list here, iPhone Alley, of course, Michael Johnston's site. Michael Johnston converts this show into AAC for your listening and viewing and linking pleasure. Next week will be more of the same, more questions like this, probably a couple more Leopard tips. We're trying to dig into Leopard and find those things that might not be so obvious. So if you find any of that stuff, please send it along. And here's where you send it. You send it to feedback@macgeekgab.com. That's one place. You can phone it in, if you're so inclined, to 206-666-GEEK, and that is, John?
4335.
That's right, 4335. Yeah. And then you can Skype it to MacGeekGab. So that's all the ways of getting it in. Please send in questions, tips, whatever you like. You know, we like to share everything here.
Easter eggs.
Easter eggs. That's what we're
looking for. Leopard Easter eggs. Yeah. Cool little things that you noticed.
Mm-hmm.
They're in there somewhere. I know it.
That's right. Like the little blue screen that we found in the sharing thing last week. That was pretty good. I like that.
It was a nice blue.
Yeah. The podcast marketplace this month has the A5 and A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebone Software, Text Expander from Smile on My Mac, one free download from Audible.com, and Harman-E-Travel.com for all of your travel needs, cruises, airfare, car rental at Macworld Expo. It's all right there. Backbeat Media Podcast Network is where you go to sponsor the show. And I think we're out of here, John. Write more iTunes comments. We love those. We really do. I really get a kick out of reading all those things. It means more than you know. So if you got a minute in your day, you want to give a little something back, but you don't necessarily have something to contribute to the show, go write us an iTunes comment. We'll love it. Thanks for staying subscribed, folks. And, while you're burning those DVDs and BitTorrenting, don't get caught.
Made up.